Welcome to Transcending Identity. I'm your host, Nicole Lee, and I am thrilled to be your guide on this incredible journey of self-discovery and transformation. This podcast is designed to help you connect deeper with yourself and transcend the identities, beliefs, and environments that may be holding you back from living your best life. Through insightful interviews, thought-provoking discussions, and practical advice, I speak with incredible people from around the world who share their stories of transformation, transcendence, and triumph. From entrepreneurs to spiritual teachers, athletes to activists, you'll learn how they overcame obstacles and reached new heights in their lives. I will also share my personal stories, insights, and tools along the way. By listening to this podcast, I hope you feel seen, supported, and inspired to live your best life. Thanks for spending time with me today. Your time to transcend starts now. Hi, love. Welcome to another episode of Transcending Identity. I am so grateful you're here, and I'm excited that you've tuned in to this episode around allyship with my amazing guest, Paul Johnson. Paul is a status quo questioner, institutional barriers buster, and aspiring ally who is passionate about developing white men into becoming more inclusive leaders. He's also the co-host of The Modern White Man, a podcast that explores the roles white men can play in diversity, inclusion, equity, and justice work. Now, Paul's journey offers a unique perspective on the intricacies and complexities of allyship. During our time together, Paul shares what it means to him to be an aspiring ally, his shift from a personal battle with guilt and shame to one of self-love on his allyship journey, the complexities of culture and racial identity as it relates to allyship and being in the equity space, the pivotal role he believes white men should take in supporting the advancement of diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice, and the importance of navigating privilege responsibly, focusing on how to support without imposing on marginalized communities. Also in the show notes, Paul shares books that have been influential in his development of a positive racial identity and his mission in supporting, amplifying, and advocating for others. I hope this episode inspires you to reflect on your own journey, recognize the power and importance of allyship, and take actionable steps towards creating a more inclusive and equitable world around you. Hey, Paul, how are you today?
Hey, Nicole, I'm great and really excited to talk to you.
I am so excited that you are here on the podcast. Knowing that one of the identities that you align with is being an aspiring ally. And I found it very interesting that you use the word aspiring as part of allyship, which I had never heard before. And I'm sure the listeners would love to know more about how you define aspiring allyship and what it means to you personally.
Yeah. So there's a few things that come to mind why I use that phrase. And there have been people who've told me, like, why don't you just call yourself an ally? You're an ally. You do the work, you're showing up. But I think it's good for me because, number one, it's humbling. It implies that I'm not there yet, and it'll always be a lifelong journey of being an ally. And that humbling part of it, I think, keeps me on my toes and keeps me learning and helps me grow and see it as something that I'm working towards rather than getting comfortable. And for someone with privileged identities, I think it's really important that we are careful about getting too comfortable and are always mindful of. So that's number one. I think secondly, too, it's actually a term that I can't take credit for at all. It's a term that I've just heard pop up in circles of DEI practitioners and activists. And my understanding of the term is that ally really isn't something that I can name myself, or especially white folks or folks with privilege can give themselves, because that's something that's really determined by those with marginalized identities, right? Those who have these marginalized identities get to decide or define who is an ally and what are allyship activities, if you will. And I think that's fair that they get to decide and assess. And then I think with identity, we have our past identity, we have our present identity, and we have our future ideal identity. And so aspiring to me implies that it is the identity that I'm working towards, and that it helps me understand that, you know, my past identity, although something to honor and definitely keep as a part of me, it's also not me and not who I want to be. And not who I want to become. So aspiring is motivating, it's future oriented. And again, it helps me stay humble and avoid that comfort around thinking that I've made it or that I'm an expert in a certain area. And I think that's, again, very important for folks of privilege to be mindful of.
That is so powerful because there's so much in society about a person is the expert. And that implies like having the answer to all things in that particular area. And I love that you're saying like, but there's more to know. There's more to explore. There's more to be exposed to. And what prompted you to start a journey of becoming an ally and being so focused on supporting marginalized groups and others who do not have privilege in the way that you see yourself?
Well, I always had a really deep sense of justice, of right and wrong. That's just something that's always been a part of my identity. And I think will always will be. It just got to a point later in life, probably in my early 20s, where that sense of justice kind of, you know, connected with the greater injustice of the world. Like, you know, up until that point, I grew up in a very sheltered, very privileged, very homogenous environment where, you know, I didn't really experience any injustices or see many injustices because I, at least for one, that's just because the veil had still been, you know, over my eyes, but also I had never really been exposed to injustices in the world. And of course, you know, aging myself here, like, you know, then the internet showed up, right? And then you started to see what's happening globally. And so it just was a natural thing to really jump into activism work and allyship work. And it's something that I can't not do. You know, I think that's when we talk about identity, you can't not be who you are. It's just a matter of how you show up and how you, in the case of allyship work, especially in race and other marginalized identities, with me being a person of privilege, it's reconciling that perceived gap and actual gap of, it feels like I'm over here and everyone else is over there. And I see the injustice, I see the gap. What can I do about that? How can I show up and how can I help and not continue to harm? And so thinking about past identity, we can go before I was even born, right? And that's something was really transformative for me to understand that there's so much injustice and so much of this marginalization, even, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years before I was even born. So this is just part of the world we live in for a long time. And so it's reconciling with that. It's reconciling with the past of our country and the role that white folks and white men in particular played in that or not played in that. And, you know, for a long time, as a person of privilege, when you first discover some of these things, you go into, I think, a lot of anger, you go into a lot of confusion, you go into also a lot of shame and guilt naturally, right? And then you have to, again, reconcile, all right, I am a white cis male. I hold a lot of privilege. I've been given a lot of advantages. It feels like I'm a bad person. And that was part of my identity for a long time, that I'm a bad person, that I don't deserve good things, that I don't deserve joy, or I don't deserve this or that. And so that was rooted in my allyship. And it felt right at the time, right? It's sort of that like, well, yeah, this makes sense. Part of, you know, my identity or the identities that I hold are responsible for bad things. So therefore, I'm a bad person, right? Or I don't deserve good things. So I would still do the work, quote unquote, but it would be out of a place of shame, guilt, you know, self-flagellation, misery, right? Like it was none of the good feelings or emotions and a lack of connection to my ancestry culture too. When you go through a period of shame and guilt, when it comes to especially your racial identity, you start to want to reject your own racial identity and therefore your ethnic or cultural identity. And so I never really felt that connection to my roots, which I think left a major hole in my own well-being and positive self-identity.
And what I also sense is almost a conflict internally, you know what I'm saying? Of I can't imagine looking at yourself in the mirror And because of the connection you made to your ancestors, because of the connection you've made to the world, looking at yourself and not liking yourself just for that very reason.
Yep. Yeah. And when you have inner conflict, you have that inner rejection, like you project that out into the world, right? And so it really made my allyship problematic in a lot of ways, because I showed up in spaces with, you know, almost like sheepishly, almost like a dog with its tail between its legs, which it's problematic. And looking back, it's problematic because that it's centering me, right? Mm-hmm. I give off this vibe that, you know, oh, woe is me. I'm this poor white dude who's feeling bad about his ancestry and everything that's happened, you know, and I essentially, you know, would be showing up into spaces and taking on energy and attention from other people, which is the opposite, right? Like, of what allyship really looks like, especially from a racial standpoint, is that it's decentering myself in the conversation, in the work. It took a long time to accept it, but yes, loving myself was the answer to better allyship. Like, it still kind of is a inner conflict of like, it just doesn't match up, right? Like, and I think that comes from just our punitive system, right? Like our punitive system where like, if you did something bad, you should be punished, right? Mm-hmm. And that's when really needed some unlearning, because I think in an equitable, inclusive world, you know, in a world where we're, you know, moving towards liberation, it's not a punitive world, right? It's a world where we aren't shamed for what we do, and we're not labeled as bad or good even, right? We just are, and we're fluid and we're changing, but we all deserve grace. And so I think that was a really, really critical, but also really challenging moment and transition in my allyship to realize that not only do I deserve love, but that's essential, as well as connecting with my ancestral roots in a positive way, and or even just accepting that, yes, I am connected with my white Caucasian ancestors, that that is what it is, right? And there's good with that, and there's obviously bad with that. And that, I think, overall was transformative in my identity development.
What was the tipping point, or were there people in your life that helped ground you to get you into that place of self-love and enough separation, right, from taking on the identities, behaviors, and attributes that were not good, weren't serving, weren't loving, so that you could show up in the way that you desired?
Yeah, there were a lot of things, and a lot of it was just learning, right? Like, okay. Reading a lot of different books and a lot of different resources and following different people on social media. And one thing that comes to mind immediately was, I'm certified in the Intercultural Development Inventory, the IDI. And so that tool was helpful in terms of even, and this is just, you know, again, speaks to the depth of the veil for folks with privilege, is even understanding that I have a culture was groundbreaking. Like, what? I have culture, right? And that is a product of growing up in the dominant culture, right? It's like you don't know the water you're swimming in, and sort of situation. And when you're in the dominant culture, it's not as apparent to you that you have culture, or you come, you know, you have, in this case, ancestry. So the exploration into my cultural roots, like, where did my ancestors come from? What were cultural elements of my ancestors? It kind of took me out of this obsession of race for a moment. Not completely out, of course, but to think about culture was helpful, because again, race is a construct. It obviously is real, right? But it's not real. It's a made up construct. Culture is real, right? And so it really, I think, got me out of this trance, or whatever you want to call it, with thinking that I'm only of my racial identity. And by understanding that I have cultural roots and ancestry, and even feeling connected to that, I think, to me, really was needed to get out of that colonial white supremacist mindset, mm-hmm. and into like this, you know, with people and connection with others and community, right? And again, looking at my culture, there's good and bad, of course, but just the simple fact of being connected to culture was huge for me. The second thing I'll say was, I already mentioned Res Momenicum, but his book, Mind Your Mind's Hands, was the first time I ever considered that he talks about how white folks or deal with racial trauma, and understanding what is racial trauma, how does that affect me as a white person, and how it shows up in my, you kind of mentioned earlier, the behaviors, the things I do, the things that I feel. And it really opened my eyes to this work as not just intellectual, but somatic and emotional, deeply based off of trauma. And so that just blew my mind in so many ways. And then the last thing I'll say is, you know, I did a podcast called The Modern White Man with a friend of mine, and he really got me down this road of the aspiring part. Let's reconcile with the history of white men, of course. What did white men do and not do in the history of this country, and how we, you know, white men contributed to the state of things today. But, or and, however you want to say it, what does our future look like as white men, right? Who do we want to be now? Now that we know what it's looked like in the past, who do we want to be, most importantly? And how does that identity connect directly with, I guess, undoing what had been done, if you will, or creating a better world, simply using our power and privilege to advance justice and equity in our world? And that was a light bulb moment for me to say, okay, yeah, I can reconcile with the past and it sucks and I feel guilt about it, but it doesn't need to end there, right? Before, that's where it just ended. Oh, it sucks. I'll still do this work, but yeah, it doesn't feel good. But now, and this comes back to hope. Hope is so motivating. You know, shame and guilt is motivating to an extent, of course, but not obviously a sustainable motivation. Hope is motivating. And for me, who I aspire to be, and that there is even a possibility that I can be the person I want to be, is hopeful. And that's a sustainable way to do this work.
Wow. It is interesting, like you say, how certain really does create internally. It's like, great, I can have hope for myself, but it does create this hope that what you're also doing will change the world. I think it's really courageous that you started a podcast and named the podcast what you did, because that was a bit provocative in itself.
You know, Ken Lawrence, he had the idea, he set up everything, he did all the editing and really all the heavy lifting. He just asked me to be a co-host, and he approached me when I still was, I would say, in that phase of some of that self-loathing. And my initial reaction was, are you crazy? Like, when he pitched the idea to me, I was like, what? Like, I thought it was a joke, because I'm like, you're saying you want to have two cishet white men go on the airwaves, take up the airwaves and talk about race and gender? Like, the last thing this world needs is two more white men mansplaining things, right? But then he explained more of the purpose and talked about how he was influenced by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum's book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And this was, you know, another part of my transformation was the idea that, you know, white folks need to do racial identity work. This comes all back to, like, when you're in the dominant culture and you're privileged, you just don't think you have to do this stuff. You don't need to think about your culture or your race, or it's just, you just live your life, right? You just are, you exist. So when he talked about, like, racial identity and this aspirational identity of working to be anti-racist and anti-sexist, I was like, oh, okay, well, I can get on board with that, right? I was a little bit more amenable to that. I still was hesitant. And to your point, I was like, I was ready for the hate mail to be coming in nonstop, right? Mm-hmm. But I would say 99% of the time, the reaction was, oh, good, I'm glad you all are talking about this, right? Like, we need white men talking about this. And it just, like, really surprised me. I was like, what, really? Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah, well, we'll keep talking about it. And I remember he and I had a conversation before we even got started. We're like, you know, if and when, right, we get criticism and we are going to, you know, gracefully listen and take the feedback and have a conversation if necessary. But we were very mindful of that from the very beginning, and saying we need to, as, you know, two white men, we need to be mindful of this, you know, critical feedback, because, yeah, it is very provocative as a title, and But what I found is when people start to listen to what we talk about, it really is needed. And we need more white men to have these conversations and have spaces to even talk about our struggles. And of course, talk about what part we can play in this. There's a really great research study that I came across called the White, I think it's called the White Men Leadership Study. It's by Great Heart Consulting. And they kind of do a state, you know, the state of things with men in DEI work. And if you look at the numbers, most white men don't feel a part of this work at all. They feel excluded. They feel, you know, at worst, they feel completely excluded and rejected. At best, we're just kind of in this like, what do I do? Like, where do I fit in? I want to do something, but what's my role? And I think that's at a macro level, just how white men are feeling in general, this word, like, what do I do? What do I not do? And to gain more clarity around what roles we can play and how critical our role is too, I think is just so important, because we have so much power and influence and privilege. Not that we earned all of that. It's just due to our identities, right? And our structures. We have so much potential to make deep, meaningful change wherever we are. And we need to be able to harness that and leverage that. And so sitting around and kind of twiddling our thumbs, or even just kind of like sitting on the margins, like not knowing what to do, like that's not helpful for anybody. There's so much potential, since we are white men, or so many white men are in positions of influence, that we need more white men to get on board and be confident in their ability to work for justice and equity.
And I did listen to the podcast, and it was enlightening. And this is just because of language I use. I found it to be beautiful, because two white men who were willing to be that vulnerable, to have conversations that I know are actually happening, but it's kind of the same situation where it's not until someone else says it, right? You know, to hear another white man say that I feel guilt or shame, or I'm confused, or I'm not sure where I sit, or I felt rejected when I actually tried to hear another white man say that, and another white man hear that, is like, oh, it's not just me. And now I want to listen in, because maybe this person actually has some information that will help me move forward. Being in corporate America for 20 years and working in spaces with white men. And yeah. I do think it's interesting that sometimes that's lost, that white men can have the same insecurities, inferiority complexes about their role when it comes to marginalized groups. However, it does not discount where I think you taking an active role to be part of the change and movement, and not sitting on the sideline waiting for somebody to invite you in.
And when you said inferiority complex, that really stirred something in me. And I think that's central to why we have so many white men who are either, again, at best waffling or wondering what to do, and then at worst fighting back, right? Like the backlash, because we have been conditioned to feel superior, to know what we're doing, to be in control, to have all the answers, to know what to do. And when it comes to this work, we don't know what the hell we're doing, right? We don't have the answers. We're not in control. We feel inferior, and there's, you know, all those insecurities come out, and essentially at the end of the day, you know, unhelpful or ineffective ways of being. This is just within the context of white supremacy too, right? So the word supremacy is key, right? So feeling supreme, feeling better than higher morality and ethics. Of course, the goal isn't to feel superior, right? But the goal is to feel empowered, to feel confident, to feel clarity, to feel in control, right? Not in control of others, but in control of yourself. And when you feel out of control, it leads to chaos, right? Both internally and externally. And so Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head there. And what I've felt personally too, of I don't know what to do and I keep messing up and I keep feeling like I may never get this, right? And so our natural instinct then when that's happening is to tap out, to say, well, then I'm not going to try at all. I'm not going to do this, right?
Have you had situations with you now being more out there, more vulnerable, more expressive, that you've actually had white men that have said, wow, that's me. How can I be better?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I've connected with a lot of amazing people, you know, being active on LinkedIn, just other white men. And it's so helpful because it's so isolating. For so long, I was isolating, thinking, am I the only white guy doing this, or who cares about this even, right? And the other thing, too, I was thinking as we're talking, like, we don't have a lot of, like, you know, historically speaking, a lot of great role models. That we have endless amounts from marginalized groups of amazing role models and people with courage and people who stood up and did the right thing. But it just feels like, and I know there's definitely lots of white men throughout history who are role models, but it feels like we had a lack of role models, you know, even present day, I'd say, right, in positions of influence and power. And so, you know, again, that goes back to, like, I don't know what I'm doing, right? It's like, it's uncharted territory in a way. And so we need others to help us along the way. And I think, you know, one thing that's critical that I want to say to white men and white folks in general, you know, who are listening, is this is why it's important to be in community with other white folks, because for a long time, I made the mistake of asking marginalized folks for help. And not to say that there are definitely people who are willing to help and have helped, but overall, and the lesson I've learned is that marginalized folks, especially folks of color, are tired. Mm-hmm. They're tired of, you know, white people coming to them and saying, I don't know what to do. Tell me what to do. And so I made that mistake for a long time of doing that, going to people I know and saying, hey, I want to help. Tell me what to do, right? Give me a list of things I can do. And essentially what I'm saying to them is, how do you help me feel better about myself? How do you help me create an image that I'm one of the good ones, right? It's not only like the labor putting on someone else to help me do the work, but it's also, again, assuaging that guilt and shame. So being in community with other white folks, having these conversations, to be able to be vulnerable is so critical. And informally had lots of great conversations with other folks. I've been in some affinity groups with other white folks, and it's so helpful to be able to say, I don't know what I'm doing. I messed up. What do I do? Like, I said this thing, it caused harm. I did this thing. What do I do? Like, help me out. And that's countercultural, right? We have been conditioned by white supremacy to not talk about race, to not hold each other accountable for things like racism and sexism. So to be able to, again, go out on a limb, right? And be courageous enough to do something countercultural is difficult, but so necessary if we ever hope to change the path and arc of our world.
Are there two or three things that you would advise someone who is privileged, white male, of what they can do to move forward, to be an aspiring ally, to help change?
I think the first thing I would say is that we white men are a critical part of this work. I mean, there's not much more to be said other than maybe it's so nuanced and there's a lot to that, but we cannot ever achieve justice, equity without involvement of white men. I mentioned earlier, we are in positions of power in, when I'm talking about like institutions. So we have the potential to make changes based off of, again, what we hear, what we know from marginalized communities. I think listening and believing, there's one thing to listen to folks of color and marginalized people, it's another thing to believe.
That's powerful.
It's really, really critical. And it's hard to believe. And I still find myself, if I hear someone, you know, they say something happened to them at work or something, like, really? Are you sure? I feel like they're embellishing a little bit. It's literally a automatic reaction, I think, for folks in privilege and power, because we don't want to believe because it means we have to do something about it, right? And it makes us feel uncomfortable. We have to change. I think the other concept that's really difficult to understand is that DEI work, or I like to say DEIJ. I don't like to think about DEI without justice, but it's not zero sum. I think that is something that it's really challenging to understand, because I know for white men, it's very much a feeling of this DEI stuff is anti-white. It's anti-white men in particular, and its sole goal is to displace us. It's to kick us out of our position and, you know, oust us from power. And, you know, it creates this image of that there's not room for all of us. So that's a difficult concept, but I think that's going to take, even for me, a long time to really understand, because if I'm completely honest, there's part of me who feels that too, like, where do I fit in this? And it just feels like I'm getting pushed out of the conversation of the group, right? So really being mindful of that narrative and the myth of that narrative is really critical, and having more of an abundance mindset of we all benefit from DEIJ work. And then the other thing I'll say too, and this is another pitch of someone who I really like and follow, Deepa Iyer, did something around the social change ecosystem. You can Google it. It's really incredible. But it talks about how there's so many different roles that people can play. And she, you know, says equity, liberation, justice work. And that's really helped me understand what role do I play and what role do I not have to play? Because sometimes we can get burned out or feel a lack of clarity when it feels like we have to play all the roles. And if we're not playing certain roles, we feel this sense of I'm not good enough. But she has all these different roles, like healers and disruptors and storytellers and experimenters and visionaries and builders.
Have heard of that. Yeah. To know that we all have a role to play.
Yeah. And there's this ecosystem, right? So that also for white men, we can find our roles that we can play and own those roles wherever we're at. And I think that's the last thing I'll say too, is we don't have to be in a position of authority to influence. We have so much potential to influence and change wherever we are. And so, you know, I'm referring obviously to the workplace, but this, you know, refers to the community or whatever you want to say, that we have the ability to influence no matter where we're at. And with that though, you know, if we're not in a position of power, it's most likely a white male in that position, or at least a white person. And so we have influence there. We have more of the ability to influence that person than anyone else. And I'll be honest, it's risky, right? I'm sure you know the term career limiting move. It's something that I kind of came across just from people saying, like, you know what you're doing there? That's a career limiting move. You probably shouldn't do that. And I'm like, well, if it limits my career, it is what it is. My ultimate goal is justice and equity. And if that means it prevents me from getting a promotion or a position, well, that's kind of the unfortunate result of that. But that's not my ultimate goal. My ultimate goal is change and influence. So yeah, influence wherever you are, but find your co-conspirators is kind of the phrase thrown around the activism space, because it's not sustainable to do it alone. So just as we talked about earlier, find others who think like you and you can be vulnerable with and can be in community with, because that's going to keep you going.
Paul, thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, your courage and vulnerability. I'm so grateful. And I know there were several books that you mentioned and references. We will make sure to have those in the show notes, as well as information of how to connect with Paul. Thank you again, Paul. I appreciate you.
Yeah, it was an honor. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope this episode enriched your life. If so, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with others. Let's continue to grow together, transcend to new heights, and create a life that truly reflects who we are. I'll see you soon on another episode of Transcending Identity.